Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of Legion of News is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News!
From high atop the milkpacking district in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon, this, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all-important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
The King's Speech wins a bunch of Oscars. Strong winds knock down trees and cause power outages. And Bernie Madoff says the whole government is a Ponzi scheme.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, prepare yourselves for this. Is Legion of News.
Good afternoon, I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Monday, February 28th, 2011. Powerful wind gusts knocked down trees and caused power outages to thousands of homes in the Portland metro area overnight. Portland General Electric reported nearly 6,000 homes lost power Sunday night into early Monday morning. Most of the outages happened in Clackamas County, where repair crews dealt with more than 4,000 customers without power. Yamhill County lost power to about 1,000 homes. PGE crews discovered most of the outages were due to short circuits caused by falling tree limbs, which hit overhead wires. About 600 homes lost power in Milwaukee along Southeast Aldercrest Road after trees fell on power lines in the neighborhood. Workers managed to restore service to all but 900 homes in Clackamas County by 6:30 a.m. this morning.
You know, if I was PG, I would just deny it. I would just downplay it. I mean, who's going to know?
Don't know why.
Seven homes lost power. Really? It seems like it was more than... No, it was seven. Amazingly enough, seven homes. Because really...
And two of those, the people were out of town.
Seriously.
So
and
what's the alarm?
One of them was a meth fire. So it's like, how? Who would even dispute that? Who would be able to challenge them in that fact? Like, no one?
You know, they are like sort of a public utility.
Oh,
maybe they're supposed to tell the truth.
Sure, fine.
By the way, and I'm sure you know this, Rick Emerson, but PGE warns homeowners to watch out for downed utility lines.
Of course. Don't mess with electricity.
No. If you see any power lines down on the ground... What should you do?
You should tell an adult.
Right.
And run away.
Don't touch them.
And
stay
scream.
At least 10 feet away.
Shriek like a girl.
And go tell an adult.
That's right. Or you'll go up like the 4th of July.
That's
Zap
right.
Rap.
Internet advertising is a $26 billion market, and as more people become aware of and are creeped out by it, the Wall Street Journal reports that privacy management is fast becoming the most popular game in town. As people learn how much their personal information is worth, the journal writes many are seeking to sell it, which is where startups come in. There are two routes a firm can take in privacy management. Some block companies from acquiring data at all. Others collect and sell it to the highest bidder. And so the downside of this is that no one really cares. But privacy services are
what are we talking about? Is somebody burgling my home when I'm not around?
Something like that, yeah.
Is Mark Zuckerberg rooting through my trash?
I think the deal is that people are starting to become... I don't know. I don't even know what I'm reading. I don't know why I read that story right now. I will admit it. I'm out of control at this moment.
Welcome to Legion of News. A one-hour conglomeration of everything you need to make your life perfect and whole. It is Monday, February 28th, 2011. Thank you for joining us today.
really, especially today, I guess. Coming up later on the hour, we got your entertainment news, also Science on the March. And if you want to get this program later on, you can do it via iTunes or as a direct MP3 download here or at legionofnews.com. You can also get it on your mobile device. That is mobile.cascadia.fm, mobile.cascadia.fm. Here is...
What?
I say, taking my life in my hands, Dawn Taylor.
U.S. Representative David Wu. Our Oregon congressman, whose erratic behavior has recently prompted calls for his resignation, said yesterday that some of his actions could be attributed to a reaction to a mental health drug. He admitted that doesn't explain the behavior documented in reports over the last month, which included sending his staff photos of himself wearing a tiger costume. Wu said he was hospitalized after his 2008 campaign for symptoms that were later diagnosed as a reaction to a common mental health drug.
Wouldn't you think that... Isn't the whole reason you take a mental health drug is because you're crazy to begin with? And so wouldn't the reaction be that you're less crazy?
Yes.
And if so, what was he doing before he started taking the drug? Was he just at home feeding squirrels into wood chippers? I'm not saying he was. I'm just asking. It's just a question.
Yeah, he said on election day of this year, he felt dizzy and confused, and his staff and family reportedly were unable to locate him. He said, it came up that afternoon, and it knocked me off my can.
What came up that afternoon?
I guess
the crazy?
I guess the crazy.
The crazy meter, was it 10?
Yeah.
Okay.
He did an interview with the Associated Press in his office here in Portland. Six staff members quit after the 2010 re-election campaign, during which the congressman gave angry speeches and talked his way inside a secure portion of Portland International Airport. He says last year's episodes were the culmination of a period of mental health challenges that began in 2008 as marital issues led towards his separation from his wife. He was treated with a prescription mental health drug that he declined to name, but described as very common.
By the way, on Friday, I had dinner with one of his former staff members.
Did you?
Who said that he wasn't, this is just in this person's assessment, in their constitutionally protected opinion, they said he was like full-on screaming crazy.
Okay.
This is just, again, I don't really know that's any sort of a clinical diagnosis. I think it may just be their read on things. Yeah, they said he was just crazy like 10 rats.
Well, politicians, kind of like pop stars and successful actors, tend to be a little bit crazy.
On the manic edge of things.
And people just sort of go along with it.
Well, because it's part of the spark that makes them magical.
Right. So when somebody is, and it's just something that it's understood, it isn't really talked about, all of the crazy. A lot of the crazy is, most of the crazy, in fact, is just sort of swept under the rug. So if someone is crazy enough in politics that his staff are calling him crazy and quitting, that's pretty crazy.
That's Charlie Sheen crazy. That's what that is.
That's wearing a tiger suit and sending emails to your staffers pretending to be your children crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, David Wu, we salute you.
He's great!
But the protesters still camped out in Wisconsin and states across the country facing major budget shortfalls. A meeting between President Barack Obama and the nation's governors today could anticipate the agenda for the 2012 presidential election.
I'm sorry, was this President Alan Thicke?
No, President Barack Obama.
Okay.
President Obama. Mr. Obama. Obama, Obama, Obama. At a White House dinner in honor of the National Governors Association meeting last night, Obama welcomed governors to Washington and urged them to find common ground to work together. He asked the nation's governors for help in his so-called Win the Future campaign to target increased funding towards education, research, and infrastructure.
What does Win the Future mean?
I have no idea.
Was that translated from the original English? Somehow,
I don't know. Or? I don't know. It just, now every time I hear the word win or winning, ooh, I think of Charlie Sheen.
Winning! I did that all weekend and no one knew what I was doing. I would just end, like, in fact, on Friday we were at dinner with some friends of ours, and it was like the guy comes over to, what would you like? And I said, well, I think we'll have a round of hors d'oeuvres to start with. Perhaps this cilantro and spinach dip. Winning! And everybody at the table just looked at me, and I realized that they all have lives and jobs, and they didn't know what the hell I was doing. I'm sorry. So
both parties have always believed that America should have the best of everything. We don't have third-rate airports and third-rate bridges and third-rate highways. That's not who we are.
Obama waded into the controversy of government union concessions that spurred protests in Wisconsin and elsewhere.
I don't think it does anybody any good when public employees are denigrated or vilified or their rights are infringed upon.
The Washington Post warns a showdown is brewing between the administration and GOP governors, some of whom who want to radically curtail spending projects, roll back the health care law, and fight labor unions, possibly in anticipation of their own presidential bids. One big issue on the table is Medicaid, which will lose billions in federal funding this July. Faced with the threat of ballooning budgets, the Wall Street Journal reports more than half the states want to kill a provision preventing them from limiting Medicaid eligibility. It's a move that could cut thousands of people out of the health insurance program.
What nobody really seems to, it just seems so obvious to me that what the Republicans are doing is they're just wrecking the entire joint. So by the time 2012 comes around, everybody goes, oh, this country sucks. We got to get somebody else to run things. Because Obama's name is on...
Yeah, it's got to be Obama's fault.
Well, because his name is on the front of the building, right? I mean, that's the sort of thing. It's like, just like Walt Disney wasn't down there, like, greasing the rides at Epcot or something to make sure they were, but his name was on the front of the corporation. So, his fortunes rose or fell with those of the Walt Disney organization. And so, therefore, they're just going to trash the entire country, I think. And then when everybody looks around in 2012 and the entire place is just like a cinder, then he'll sort of bear the brunt of that.
Plus, if a whole lot of us die because we can't get any kind of health care, that's less of us they have to convince.
Crazy like a fox you are.
Yeah.
It's Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. Later on this hour, we got your Science on the March. Also, entertainment news coming up later on. Next hour, the Rick Emerson radio program storms the airwaves around the world, featuring Corpse Watch, Taser Watch, Penis Watch. Mr. Ryan White from the Oregonian will be here, music editor from the Oregonian. And we'll have clue number one in the next round of E.H. Vending's Name That Snack. That is all coming up next hour at RickEmersonShow.com. Plus, a top five from Don Taylor.
Indeed.
Awesome.
The last known American survivor of World War I died on Sunday. Frank Buckles, 110, was one of nearly 5 million Americans that served in the forces in 1917 and 18, and he never imagined he'd be the last one alive. I knew there'd be only one someday, he said a few years ago, as popular attention turned to the dwindling number of survivors. I didn't think it would be me. Born in Missouri, Buckles joined the Army at age 16 after telling the recruiting officer he was old enough to join. Buckles spent the war behind the front lines, driving trucks and working in warehouses in England and France. Buckles also spent time as a civilian POW in the Philippines in World War II before settling on a farm in West Virginia to raise a family. He's a widower, and he died there of natural causes while being tended by his daughter.
Did he really say there can be only one?
I knew there'd be only one someday, he
awesome.
Said.
Well done, sir.
As he roamed the countryside with his giant swords tucked in the back of his overcoat.
Which was ringed with onions. Fare thee well, William Buckles. Here's Don Taylor.
From his prison cell in North Carolina, Bernie Madoff is refashioning himself as one of the financial sector's harshest critics. When he gets phone privileges, anyway, he gave an interview to New York Magazine, accusing the whole government of being a Ponzi scheme and deriding efforts at financial regulation as useless. The Securities and Exchange Commission looks terrible in this thing, he says, adding, it's unbelievable. Goldman, no one has any criminal convictions. The whole new regulatory reform is a joke. He has similarly harsh words for his clients. Look, he said, none of my clients, even if they lost every penny they put in there, can plead poverty. Look, it doesn't mean I'm excusing what I did. Doesn't mean I don't feel sorry for them. On a personal note, Madoff reflected on his son's suicide and his estranged relationship with his family, who he claims never knew about his illegal activities. My wife doesn't forgive me, but at least she understood, he said, of their current relationship. I mean, you know, I destroyed our family.
I like the idea that he's sort of just embraced it, that he's sort of like a Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor sort of a thing. He's just sitting there kind of like, hey, what do you want? I'm evil. What do you expect me to do? And also, you can't stop it from happening again. And also, your country's economy leaks like a sieve. So, well, all right. The thing about Madoff is he's another one of those guys that, improbably enough, had like $1 jillion that he stole from everybody else and yet had no hair. He had like the rug that he was wearing.
He had no time. He had no time to sit down and get the hair transplant. He had no time.
So it's like, yeah,
busy swindling.
He was like, what's his name? James Traficant and Phil Spector, where he was just walking around with some sort of like the, you know, like the weave or the whatever on top of his head that he was adjusting every now and again. So, here's the thing about Bernie Madoff is that he references the entire government being a Ponzi scheme, which makes me feel bad for whoever like Ponzi was.
Yeah.
You know, and like his family, because somewhere there's like a Ted Ponzi who's just trying to start up a business, and nobody's going to invest in that.
Well, there's a Ponzi winery. And apparently they're okay with being called the Ponzies. They're just like,
is it here?
I'm not sure where it is. It might be here. I know that I've seen. I believe it is here.
Have I already made the observation that there should be some sort of a 50s greaser-based scheme run by a guy called the Ponds? I don't know if I did that, if that was just a thing
I
thought.
No, I think all that's right. Just a thing that, and it might have been better, like, just
let's go hang out with Ponzi. And then he's a guy who just sits on a motorcycle and takes your money.
Hey, and trust me.
Yeah. He says, I tell you about a downline. Hey.
Yes, Ponzi Vineyards, by the way, is here in Oregon.
All right.
So, yes. The King's Speech emerged from the 83rd Academy Awards with perhaps many, many Oscars. I decided not to read the horrible, stupid puns that were written on the page in front of me, and I had nowhere to go. It was like I just drove that truck into the wall.
Just skip to the end.
Just save everyone the misery. The period drama about King George VI and his speech therapist won Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay. Colin Firth picked up an Oscar for Best Actor.
It just sounds like a joke. I mean, it really just this seems like some sort of a faux film that would be referenced in something else. This would be like the movie in a movie. The idea that that you're sitting there for 2 hours watching a guy talk to a British speech therapist.
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems like a parody of something that would be released by Hollywood.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know.
Well, no, it does. It seems like, you know, it's one of the movies inside of Tropic Thunder.
Yeah.
Where you know.
Or like a guy's just getting like a bridge put in over like, you know, like in a part of his mouth. You know, for 90 minutes, and then you're watching it going, oh, it's astounding. Will they be able to fill the cavity properly?
I have to say, it was one of probably my top 10 or 15 favorite movies of the year. I wouldn't, you know, said it was the best movie I saw.
But what is
it? It was really formulaic, but it's like,
But what's the real competition for that? Either that going to be that or Tron Legacy? I mean, is it the... It's not like there were a lot of pictures really swinging for, you know, the best thing you'd ever seen.
Well,
last
Inception
year.
Was really, really very good.
Yes, it's good that he was honored properly. Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah, no.
No.
Yeah, it won a bunch of awards and yet, strangely, did not seem to have a director. No one directed it. But yeah.
I'm not trying to be a negative, Nelly. Just saying I feel that I feel the film was somewhat overlauded.
Yes, it was. No, it definitely was. And that's the opinion of an awful lot of actual film critics that of my acquaintance. I know after it won last night, my friend Scott Weinberg wrote on Twitter that it's nice to see the Academy is awarding TV movies now. And I responded, I said, well, it's not the first time, you know, reference Jeremy Irons in Reversal of Fortune. I mean,
right.
It's, you know, the Academy, a bunch of old white people, and they do like their period dramas, and they do like that particular formula.
And if that movie, if you had left everything intact, but it was somehow set, like, in Indiana, I don't think it would have won anything.
No,
I mean, it's just that whole, you know, it has that, it falls into that, the aegis of... You know, it has that sort of the British kind of elan.
Yeah, it made you feel like you were watching something highbrow when really you were watching something that had the same template as your basic Lifetime movie.
Right.
You know, so it won hands down in what's been pitted as a rivalry with The Social Network. Tom Hooper, director of The King's Speech, was named Best Director. And he says he still can't believe that the King's Speech screenplay went unproduced for so long.
I think I didn't quite believe that there were masterpieces sitting unread in attics. You know, I kind of thought the system worked.
That's not a masterpiece. Come on.
It's like he's talking about sitting at a lunch counter in Selma. You know, the system is hopelessly broken, Don.
Colin Firth was named Best Actor for his portrayal of the King trying to overcome his stutter. He says it touched a lot of people, but he doesn't consider it a message film.
I don't think it sent a message. I just think maybe it just shines a light on something which badly needed it.
It happened like 60 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting little story.
Yes, but I'm just saying...
I know.
And I guess it was more than 60. It was actually 80 years ago. The idea that... Well, hold on.
I don't think it sent a message. I just think maybe it just shines a light on something which badly needed it.
Because my life is a lot better now.
I'm sure it really badly needed it.
Really, having been made aware of everything that happened, I feel like I'm a more complete individual.
Natalie Portman won the Best Actress Oscar for Black Swan, but almost as much attention was being paid to the fact that she had a great big... giant parasite, like, riding along.
So you mean a baby bump, Don?
Yes, I'm sorry. A baby bump.
To whom is she married?
I don't know.
Some guy who's not me, and so therefore doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Portman says she couldn't tell whether her baby had any reaction to the big win.
The baby was definitely kicking a lot during the song portion of the show. Little dancer.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, producers tried to liven up the ceremony by bringing in James Franco and Anne Hathaway.
How did that work out? Here was the great thing about it, though. It was almost like this Dada-esque masterpiece in that you could just tell he didn't care. Like, for Franco, anyway. Anne Hathaway seemed to be overcompensating a little bit by just being ebullient about, like, everything.
I think she was trying to, like, overcompensate for the fact that he was just so low energy. And the show started, and it was so slow and so awkward and so uncomfortable at the beginning. So she did this thing. And I think, you know, you've performed on stage. And there is this thing I think you do sometimes where you're like, I'm just going to amp up my own energy to see if I can, like, compensate for the fact this other person is bombing.
Or if you just feel like the crowd isn't with you.
Right.
If the audience is just not, like, they're just some nights you just get a dead crowd, and they just sit there and they kind of go, and they don't really, they're not really into it, and you can just see that the energy in the room is low. And so, yeah, you just start doing the verbal, you start doing the onstage the performance equivalent of just putting lots of exclamation marks and emoticons with everything.
It felt very much like a show that's produced by people, you know, in their 60s who've been doing this for a long time, who realized because The Social Network was such a big movie, they thought to themselves, well, I bet a bunch of those kids who read the Facebook are going to be watching the Oscars. We need to pander to them, but had no idea how.
How to do it.
We'll get a couple of people who are actually, you know, under 40, and we'll have James Franco come on reading the texts off of his phone, and we'll do an auto-tune thing. That'll be brilliant. And it was just so cringe-inducing and so horrible. The show, from start to finish, so much of it was just so awful. It was so awful. People got excited to see Billy Crystal. Well, that's how awful it was.
I mean, and that's, you know, and I have never been one of those people who finds Billy Crystal funny. I know that the rest of the country does. The rest of the country somehow took a vote and decided that he and Robin Williams and Whoopi Goldberg were all, like, hilarious. And I was gone, or I was in the bathroom or something when they did that. What Billy Crystal seems like is sort of, he seems like an amusing but not threatening choice for the Oscars in every way. I don't have anything against him. He seems like a nice enough guy, I suppose. I just never really found him funny. And so it was a mark of just how bad it was last night and just how lackluster and listless it was that when Billy Crystal showed up, it was like a gust of just sweet cleansing air had blown into the room that was scented with citrus and mint.
Yeah. So, in a way it was just sort of sad, really, because it was like they were just rubbing salt in our wounds, reminding us of when we actually used to enjoy watching the Oscars, which was not last night.
No, well, and they've done that a few other times. There was that year that it might have been the year that Jon Stewart hosted, which, you know, and Stewart was. Was it Stewart that hosted the Grammys? The Oscars, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
There was this sort of consensus the next day that he wasn't bad, but he was a little over his head. He didn't seem comfortable in his own skin there.
I liked him.
I thought he was good, too.
But I liked it the year that Letterman did it, too, and people thought that he bombed as well. So.
And I guess bombing is a relative sort of thing. The thing about Stewart is I thought Stewart was funny, but I think that as the night went on, he began to think that he wasn't doing very well, and so that crept into his performance. Mm. You could see that he felt like he was just like, oh God, I'm sucking it. But what they did that year that Stewart hosted, which really did him no favors, is they not only did, you know, they do the Dead Parade every year, and then they also did, like, the cavalcade of other guys who've hosted the show.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like they end with Carson, who is just such a master at it, and then they go back to poor Jon Stewart, who's just sitting on stage looking like he's about 3 inches high, going, I suck. And I just felt so bad for him.
Well, what they did last night was it was like they had the holographic dead Bob Hope.
Yeah.
To remind you of, like, the glory days of Bob Hope. And then some kind of creepy fake Bob Hope voice introducing James Franco and Anne Hathaway, who come back out and is like, and here we are, back to suck.
Well, and Franco looked like he was, I don't know that he was stoned, but I would just say that if you were to show me a picture of him and to say, would you believe that this man has been doing some drugs? I would say yes, I believe that.
Well, as I shared on the Twitter last night, I told people they should be kind to him because, you know, he's had a long day and he's tired and, of course, completely baked. And then later I said, you know, no, he's not stoned. He's just been reading what everyone's been saying about him on Twitter backstage and crying like a little girl. But yeah, no, he looks stoned. And then it was like he was sharing his weed with Jake Gyllenhaal, you know, and a number of other people, because then it was like everybody else who's coming out, the energy was so low.
It was the dullest Oscars I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Hands down, it was the most boring Oscar ceremony ever.
It was bad in so many ways. On a happier note, though, I live tweeted the Oscars. Didn't intend to, but I just found myself wanting to share my snark with someone other than Patrick. And so I live tweeted the Oscars last night, and now I have a ridiculous number of new people that are following me on Twitter, and was, I guess, retweeted enough that for a while I was a trending topic.
Excellent.
In Portland.
Was that because of the cunning use of the hashtag?
No, it was just me making with the funny that enough people were retweeting me.
Oh, and
that,
so people would just, so it wasn't people who were tracking the Oscars
no.
as such. It was people go, well, that is an amusing jibe. Let me pass that along to whoever.
Right, to retweet. And then, yeah, so I've never been a trending topic on Twitter before. So.
Well done, Don Taylor.
Look at me. Because it is all about me.
The thing about Franco, just my final thought about that is that, I don't even want to say, like, in his defense, but just, I went back and I was reading some of the sort of interviews that they had done with him beforehand. I mean, not like last night, but in the weeks leading up to this, and he didn't really seem to care, like, ever. Hmm. I mean, I saw that he was interviewed about it, and he said, "Well, it might suck." He goes, "I might just be terrible." And apparently, I forget where I read this. This might have been on Drudge or something last night. I guess as he was getting ready to go on stage last night to begin the entire thing, so he's standing backstage at the Kodak Theater, or whatever, and he's getting ready to go out. And one of the last things he said backstage to the crew before he went out is, "Well, I don't know. This could be pretty bad tonight." And then it's like, and then he just goes out, and sure enough.
Well, he had read the jokes that they'd written for him.
Yeah.
So he knew before we did.
Somebody noted that he actually didn't. That he probably didn't rehearse a lot because he's busy, because he's going to Yale or something. He has a massive course load at Yale, and he's doing nine different pictures.
And he's on General Hospital.
Is he still on General Hospital?
I think he might be. I don't know. Maybe he's not. But he was on General Hospital.
Okay. Well, all right then.
Yeah,
so,
no.
I mean, if he truly just didn't care, I mean, if he truly was just, you know, just thought the entire thing was sort of ridiculous, but he's not going to say no to the exposure and the paycheck, then I guess I can sort of respect that in a strange way.
Yeah.
If he's just like, "F it, it's dumb. It's rich people congratulating other rich people. I don't care. I'm not going to work that hard." I could almost get with that.
And there was a few of those moments last night of different people giving speeches and the underlying sort of message underneath, sort of like it was at the Golden Globes this year.
We're awesome.
There was actually a surprising number of people who had sort of a, and you know, these awards really don't matter, kind of a subtext underneath their speech, which is kind of interesting.
I think that has become more and more the case with every, I don't think. For example, I think the idea that you're going to put, starring Academy Award winner, you know, so-and-so on the front of a DVD, I think that matters less and less, if for no other reason than people aren't looking at the front of the DVD anymore.
Well, and also, when you start diluting the pool with things like Academy Award winner Cuba Gooding Jr., you know, it's like, okay, it means less and less all the time.
Do you get the sense he exists only to be referenced, as a way of pointing out that the Academy Awards sometimes are unimportant?
Since radio, yes.
That's kind of his thing. It's just him and Louise Fletcher. That's the purpose they serve.
Let's do science.
Here's your Science on the March for Monday, February 28th, 2011. Brought to you by Squires Electric. Find out more about them by going to squireselectric.com.
A pair of visiting shuttle astronauts ventured out on a spacewalk at the International Space Station today, tackling a hodgepodge of maintenance jobs and an experiment to capture the invisible vacuum of space. Stephen Bowen and then Alvin Drew floated out the hatch and went straight to work on an extension power cable. Bowen, the lead spacewalker, is a last-minute addition to Discovery's last crew. He's filling in for an astronaut who hurt himself in a bicycle crash last month. Drew, meanwhile, became the world's 200th spacewalker when he emerged from the 220-mile-high complex. Alvin will now be able to say that he works in a vacuum, Mission Control said. They're funny. Mission Control couldn't resist a little Academy Awards humor at the expense of injured astronaut Timothy Copra, who monitored the action from a flight controller seat. In a morning message to the Discovery crew, Mission Control set up a cartoon showing a spacewalking astronaut, Bowen, holding an Oscar statue and giving an acceptance speech. He said, the cartoon spacewalker said, "And I'd like to thank all the little people that made this EVA happen, and a special shout out to Timmy Copra. Get well, little buddy."
Nerds should never try to be funny.
No.
Geeks can be funny. Nerds, not funny.
No.
Did you see that creepy picture of the space shuttle with the shadow on it?
No.
So there's this great picture of the space shuttle in, I don't know, but, you know, geosynchronous orbit or whatever, but it's in orbit. You know, it's in space above the Earth. And so it's a picture of the space shuttle from the top looking down at the space shuttle. And it kind of weirds you out for a minute because you can't figure out why there is a shadow over the space shuttle. Because theoretically, if you're in space, what would be casting a shadow over the space shuttle?
Yeah.
And just a, and like and a shadow.
The Death Star.
And it's not even a shadow like the back half of a Discovery. It's a shadow that's just sort of like a stripe across the middle of the space shuttle. And you're looking at it going, well, what the... How does... Why is there a... And then you realize, if you look at the caption of it, it's because there's a photograph... Because the photo of the space shuttle was taken by a guy on the space station. And so a guy in the space station was looking out the window, saw the space shuttle beneath him, and decided to take a photo of it. And this is... And somebody made this observation last night. I can't take credit for this. But this this photo was one of those things that was instantly like all over the net. It was like one of the most forwarded photos on Yahoo News or something. But somebody noted on a message board that really you don't really need to wait for your flying car because the future is now. There's a guy on a space station taking a high resolution photograph of the space shuttle which is flying beneath him, which he is then immediately uploading to the internet so that everybody on the ground can see it on their miraculous handheld computers. I mean, we really are living, like, in, you know, then is now.
And yet we still have no personal jetpacks.
I know. Well, that's only because it would melt the lower half of your torso, apparently.
Mm. Over the past several years, Iceland has been in the news for two reasons. Its spectacular banking collapse and the equally spectacular volcanic ash explosion that canceled air travel around the world last year. Now the country is trying to use the latter to fix the former. Bloomberg reports that Icelandic officials are looking into harnessing the geothermal energy produced by volcanoes and hydropower produced by glaciers that lie beneath its surface through a 727-mile power cable to Scotland. With enough energy to power 5 million homes, the cable could potentially allow Iceland to remake itself as Europe's leading source of renewable energy. Icelanders live with earthquakes and volcanic activity, but the benefits that are now that we can monetize those powers, Reykjavik economist Vladimir Arman said. But they've got competition. Denmark and Norway are also working on their own clean energy initiatives.
When you picture those countries, don't you just picture like a sort of a fortress of solitude, just sort of a vast expanse of just sparkling, glistening white of you know, and just nothing else?
In my mind, they always look exactly like tiny little villages in like England and Wales. Like there's nothing but one-story buildings and cobblestone streets, and everyone has window boxes with flowers in them, which doesn't really make any sense because in my mind it's also always like 10 degrees below zero.
Yeah.
So, you know. And they all wear wood shoes.
And all the chicks look like they all look like Colonel Klink's secretary from Hogan's Heroes.
They're all blonde and they have pigtails.
Yeah, like the Swiss Miss girl.
Yeah. I have a feeling, though, that's not actually true.
Probably not.
If a wolf is watching something, don't look in the direction of the chickens hiding in the coop.
I'm sorry? Was that a parable? Was that a...
Yes. That was something Confucius once said.
Okay. That was...
No. Anyway, if you have chickens... don't look in their direction if a wolf is nearby.
Daily aphorisms from Don Taylor.
Wolves know to follow a human's gaze to find hidden objects, according to recent research. And this is similar to something we were talking about recently with the dogs, that dogs, and I guess wolves as well, can actually follow what you're doing with your eyes. Following the gaze of another creature can be vitally important in the wild. It can tell an animal where prey is or the direction of a threat. But figuring out that there might be something hidden behind what another animal is staring at takes talent. Scientists consider it to be a more advanced thought process, previously only seen in a few animals such as humans, chimps, and ravens. Animal behaviorists Friedrich Range and Zsofi Virani of the University of Vienna found that captive-raised wolves would detour around an obstacle if it was in another wolf's or even a human's line of sight. If there was nothing interesting there, the wolves stopped responding to repeated looks. If the human was staring blankly, though, the wolves didn't stop reacting. As young as 14 weeks, wolves followed the direction of a blank stare and only later would develop the skill to look around watched objects. This supported the idea that two separate thought processes were being used to follow different types of gazes. So there you go. Wolves.
Okay.
They look at stuff. Okay.
Is that like a demotivational poster you were doing there?
Wolves, they look
at stuff. And winning!
RoboVPC, a toy-sized humanoid, won the world's first full-length marathon for two-legged robots on Saturday, beating its closest rival by a single second after more than 2 days of racing.
Where did this take place?
Where do you think?
Japan.
Japan.
Okay.
five bipedal machines began the nonstop 26.2-mile contest on a 100-meter indoor track in the western Japanese city of Osaka on Thursday morning after doing knee bends or raising their hands to greet spectators.
Okay.
One of the competitors retired after finishing only the first lap, but the others continued running day and night, getting up by themselves every time they fell to the floor, or getting into collisions with rivals.
I have a question. Okay, so, I mean, everybody talks about we live in a shrinking world where everything is interconnected and we have one big global economy and there's a new world order in which all of the all of the technological and economic ramifications of one country are intertwined with those of another. Why does Japan just have all the cool stuff and none of it's over here? They're having a marathon in which the only competitors are robots.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like, and we're still using a toaster from like 1985 in the kitchen here. Why can't we get some robots over here?
I mean that
sincerely.
No, I don't know. I don't know either. Japan is just lousy with robots.
But I mean, doesn't it seem like Japan is living in not just a different country, but a different century?
They're living in a different future than we are. Absolutely.
I don't understand what the holdup is. Well, like where the X factor is in stopping those robots from being over here.
Well, I remember reading stories at one point, reading about like how all these people had, you know, in Japan, particularly the young folk, had cell phones and they texted each other all the time to let each other know where they were going to be and what they were going to do. And they were in constant contact on their phones, texting and looking up like restaurants to eat at and stuff on their phones. And I remember I thought, that's crazy. That was like 8 years ago.
Yeah. No,
and now it's taken almost a decade for us to live in the same future that Japan is in.
Is this the thing where, like, because we have that listener of ours who is in Japan for the Rick Emerson show, that guy, Riven, I think his name is, and he teaches English to the Japanese youth. So is it a thing where he could just, like, I don't know, where he could just, like, get a robot and stick it in his bag and bring it home?
Maybe.
And then we could just have it in the studio sort of walking around and stabbing people?
Yeah, we need robots. We need maybe not stabby robots, but robots that make milkshakes in their tummies or you know, bring us kittens. You know, or something.
It just seems like it's one of those things, and there's money to be made there. I mean, there's enough guys with disposable income. I mean, if you look through a ThinkGeek catalog, I mean, if there was a robot in there, I mean, that's a thing that you get a second job just to afford. You'd drive a cab for a few weeks just to buy that.
And once you start manufacturing more and more robots and people start buying them, the prices go down, and then we have robots. And then we're living in iRobot, or Skynet comes, and everyone dies. But until then, it's a paradise.
Showing the subtlety and sophistication that is the hallmark of the Legion of News listener, Andrew says, I would never want America to be like Japan. They like incest and throw-up sex. All right.
Oh, thank you, Andrew, for crystallizing the whole global situation like that.
Okay. It's almost like Boutros Ghali is in the room with us. You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. This is Science on the March. Here is Don Taylor.
They like incest and throw up sex?
Yes.
That's all the. That's all our
stuff. I'll just end things there. All right. That's your Science on the March brought to you by Squires Electric. Find out more by going to squireselectric.com. That is squireselectric.com or calling 503-252-1609. By the way, this is a day where you might want to do that because you may be experiencing power issues. And it's one of those things where the power gets knocked out or the lines get taken down. Sometimes that also causes a surge and things. Or it's like, have you ever done this? You've just been sitting around at home and you hear like a bang, and it's because the transformers out on the power line have blown. And apparently that can have some sort of a, I don't know, it's not a ripple effect, but it's some sort of electrical equivalent of that, where then it surges into your house. Like, the power surge is a terrifying thing. When they'll say, like, you know, like you get those power strips or whatever that have a surge protector on them. The power surge are a little freaky because everybody that I've talked to about electricity, like when we had Joe Squires in, and several listeners said the same thing. They said it's easier to understand electricity if you think of it as being like water. They said if you visualize electricity sort of as behaving the way water does, you know, and then the wattage is the pressure and the volts are like the amount or something. And so whenever there's a power surge, it freaks me out a little bit because then I just picture the electricity just spraying out of the side of the wall like a hose. Walking by and just sort of, you know, it takes me down to the knees or something. I don't know that that's happening in your house. I mean, it might be. It seems like a thing that you may not know either. It seems like that's a trial and error sort of a thing. You may just discover that rather suddenly and unpleasantly at one moment. But In any event, if you've got electrical issues in your home, you contact Squires Electric, 503-252-1609. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors, and they are longtime supporters of Legion of News and the Rick Emerson radio program. So if it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, contact Squires Electric at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. They are proud sponsors of Science on the March. Here is Don Taylor.
The American Academy of Pediatrics is calling for laws to block minors from going to tanning parlors. Pediatrician Dr. Sophie Balk says it's needed to protect youths from something potentially harmful.
Tanning.
If you're exposed early in your life, under the age of 35, your risk of skin cancer goes up.
John Overstreet of the Indoor Tanning Association says parents should know there's no scientific evidence that tanning is any more of a health risk for younger people.
As long as this exposure is moderate, as long as they're not sunburned, as long as they don't overdo it, as long as the parent's involved in making the decision, there's absolutely no problem with doing it.
You know, being a mouthpiece must be the best and worst job on earth.
Yeah.
Because you just have to go out there and just, you know, and just peddle a bunch of hogwash. I'm not saying that this is hogwash, of course. I'm just saying in general, in toto. You know, just being some flack or some shill. I mean, that's got to be a job that it pays really well, but it's just a wash because you just go home every night and just open a bottle of Yukon Jack before you're even in the door.
I mean, considering everything we know about the harm that that the sun and UVA rays and all that do to skin, it kind of makes logical sense.
By harm, you mean cooking.
Yeah, it cooks it. And eventually gives you cancer if you overcook it too much, and or if you have a certain genetic predisposition towards that. So it kind of makes sense that when you are young and your skin is like extra fresh and soft and
buttery, Dawn.
And buttery and you know with the creamy nougat underneath, that would be when it would be even worse for you. So, but God knows, you know, I'm more likely to believe the guy who's talking for the Indoor Tanning Association.
And what a reputable organization that must be. And what? How does that guy get that job? Like, is this, you know, is he some guy that has, like, a degree in communications and mass marketing from Harvard, and then he just ends up working for a company that makes tanning beds? It's got to be a strange D-class A sort of a way
he's,
to live.
He's basically Aaron Eckhart after he washed out from the big tobacco
at
industry.
At the end of Thank You for Smoking.
It has to get, like, a job somewhere. And so now he's speaking for the Indoor Tanning Association.
By the way, I am pleased to note that they note that they say, actually, in the piece that if you are young, under the age of 35, so what that means is I am barely out of my youth right now.
Yeah,
just
so
I have only within the last year or two have I left the flowering rose of youthdom.
Well, 37 is the new 12.
That's right, Don.
Overstreet argues, in fact, doing this would only put teens at greater risk of skin cancer.
You're not going to stop teenagers from getting a suntan. What you're going to do is send them outside when there's nobody to watch them and where they're much more likely to get sunburned.
So really, if you don't,
there's nobody to watch them.
So really, if you don't send your kids to a tanning salon,
right.
You hate your children and are a bad parent.
Yes, they will end up with huge tumors all over their skin.
So your kids actually, really, in the grand scheme of it, they can't afford not to tan at the tanning parlor.
Really, it's in their best interest, honestly.
I think if I could just speak for everybody else, by the way, at least I don't know if this has changed. I suspect that it hasn't. But just as a confidential from, like, men to confidential to tanning teens, you know, here's the thing. Nothing looks weirder or more off-putting than a chick who's just completely and totally tan in the middle of winter, especially in a place like Portland. It just looks strange. I know that tan skin is, you know, supposed to look great and hot and whatever, and I guess it does within the right context, but like, December in Portland is not the right context. You
no.
just look odd.
And even in, like, California, it looks odd. We're in the middle of winter in California, and some of those tans on the Oscars last night, somebody on Twitter pointed out that Zachary Levi, the guy from Chuck who mm-hmm. sang the song from Tangled, that when you get the spray tan, if you're going to roll up the sleeves of your shirt, you should do the forearms, too.
Yeah.
Because the whole neck and head did not match the forearms.
Here's the other
thing. Matthew McConaughey looked like Fonzie crust with an Oompa Loompa.
The other thing is this, if you're going to do the spray-on tan or the rub, the cream tan or whatever, don't just do the forearms. Do the forearms instead of doing the palms of your hands. Because that's a thing that shouldn't be orange.
No.
You know what I mean? So, just FYI.
I just embrace the fact that I am white as the driven snow.
Yeah.
I grew up by the beach, and I just stopped even trying to tan at about the age of 18 or 19 because it was just a failure anyway. I have almost no melanin in my skin at all. So I just had to finally just go, you know, that's it. I'm pale.
You're not pale, Dawn. You're alabaster.
That's it. And then I moved to Portland where it's like, you know, hey, I have an excuse.
You're among your people.
It's been a memorable 4 years at the Atlantic for blogger and Trig Palin conspiracy theorist Andrew Sullivan. On Sunday, Sullivan announced he's moving his ever-expanding Daily Dish blog to the Daily Beast in April. Sullivan reassured his fans that he will retain total editorial responsibility for what appears in his column, and there won't be a change in the content. Beast/Newsweek impresaria Tina Brown praised Sullivan as a political blogging pioneer who writes obsessively about everything from politics to his pet beagles and brings in 1.2 million unique visitors a month. Sullivan's latest in a group of commentary celebs to join Brown's operation, including Howard Kurtz and Peter Boyer. The New York Post reports Brown has been wooing Sullivan for 10 months, but he only agreed to jump ship after the Daily Beach merged with Newsweek, ensuring Sullivan an additional platform for columns and essays.
It's become really difficult for me to track all of those guys. It's just too, I guess it's a good problem to have, but there's become such a torrent, such a flood of people online who write things that I find interesting and compelling and funny and smart and whatever that I can no longer, I mean, in a way, you do understand why people pine for, like, you know, like the days of, you know, going to see, you know, Andy Hardy or something, because growing up, and it was just like Time and Newsweek and Rolling Stone, you know, and, yeah, you know, maybe if you were a hippie, the Utney Reader or something.
And your local newspaper.
And your local newspaper. And then, of course, the Reader's Digest, which was sort of the end, the rest of the publishing world. And then you could safely say that you had read, like, everything that had been written that month. You know, like, I've read every column that's been written on every subject in the continental United States. But now it's like you could have a full-time job doing nothing but reading blogs 15 hours a day and you would never, ever, ever keep up, even with 10% of them.
And if you're at all like me, every single day you have people on Facebook or in email or wherever throwing things at you and saying, you really should read. I assume you saw this already. And you're just going,
OMG, read for lulz.
I'm like,
it's so hard.
There's so many things. And then I feel bad. I feel like a slacker because, oh, my God, that's right. I haven't been reading the New York Times this week.
Yeah.
I was like, according to a report from Moody's Analytics that will be released later today, 700,000 jobs will disappear by the end of next year if Republicans get their way with budget cuts. The report, authored by Moody's chief economist Mark Zandi, echoes the findings of a recent Goldman Sachs report and estimates that the $61 billion in cuts would shrink economic growth by 0.5% before the end of 2011 and diminish growth by 0.2% next year. But Zandi adds that doesn't mean that a reduction in spending isn't needed. In order to get the deficit down, lawmakers will need to cut $400 billion a year for the rest of the decade. Democrats have been willing to make some cuts, but they've been resistant to the size of GOP demands. On Friday, the Democrats agreed to trim $4 billion for the first 2 weeks of March, which Politico deemed a win for Republicans. But the Moody's report suggests neither side will win anything. Compromise would be the most encouraging signal for recovery, and Zandi predicated that the cuts will end up being in the neighborhood of $30 billion.
Have we thought about just robbing other countries? You know, or just like when Canada's asleep, we just go over and just sort of burgle their, you know, wherever it is they keep their loonies or whatever it is that they, whatever.
Their loonies.
Waffles or whatever it is they buy things with. In that,
their lupins.
In that, their Linden dollars. We should totally switch to the Linden dollar as the standard. The U.S. should totally be on the Linden standard. That would be awesome. That's a thing that Japan will do. You know that there's going to emerge some second economy in Japan that is totally based on Linden dollars. All right. That's a reference that is not going to work in like 5 years. That whole joint is just going to go bankrupt, and I won't be able to make that joke anymore.
We're darks.
Yeah.
Teacher pay and job security are at the forefront of many local and state budget battles. Steve Perry, founder of Hartford, Connecticut's Capital Prep Magnet School, well, I guess he needs a second job, says recessionary times are forcing many state governments to butt heads with teachers' unions.
I was going to do a whole thing just there where I sang something about budgets like Steve Perry, but I can't really do that. It would just come out in my dumb metal voice, and then it wouldn't really work. What is this, budget one?
Schools.
I'm sorry.
Schools one.
We absolutely are dealing with two extremes, and I think that the circumstances have created that. We have the worst economic times of at least my life, and we have a set of circumstances in which children still need to be educated. So we have to look at solutions.
Is that the slap chop guy?
I was going to say Steve Perry's turned strangely urban.
Perry says current collective bargaining contracts for teachers have the potential to harm students.
Because of the way in which the collectively bargained contracts currently operate, it takes at least 1 year to get rid of a teacher. That means that if your child was taking Spanish 1 with a teacher who was ineffective, when it comes to Spanish 2, they're not going to have had the opportunity to reconcile that. That means that the child loses.
Wow, you're really right. It does sound like what's his name? What is that guy?
I don't remember. I just expect him to end by offering me steak knives.
I've already forgotten the name of the slap chop guy. Yeah. God, our culture moves fast.
Yes.
Hey, do you remember the name of the chocolate rain guy?
No.
Really?
I'm not sure I ever knew the name of the chocolate rain guy.
Now that surprises me. I thought you. That's a thing that I thought you would have committed to memory.
I have a tendency to like just sort of let internet trends kind of wash into and then off of my brain so that I don't get too much like, you know, spaghetti cat and chocolate rain things like loitering in my brain meats.
Okay. All right. I'm in your brain meats, slowing your synaptic responses.
Yes.
I was trying to find this slap chop soundbite that I have set aside somewhere. It was just the one where he. It was just the one where he says. For reasons that...
You're going to love my nuts.
There you go. That's
there you go. He does. He sounds like the slapjack guy.
Because of the way in which the collectively...
Oh, my God. It's uncanny.
Do I have an ear or do I?
Because of the way in which the collectively bargained contracts currently operate, you're going to love my nuts.
That's okay. I have a brand new toy. I'm just going to save that and I'll revisit that next hour.
Okay.
Awesome.
Let's do entertainment.
Here's your entertainment news. Don't forget the Rick Emerson radio program comes to your ear holes. That is next hour at rickemersonshow.com. That is rickemersonshow.com. Today we got Corpse Watch, Taser Watch, Penis Watch, Mr. Aaron Duran with The Week in Geek. And I don't even know what this means.
We have a Darwin Watch now, too. Something
really?
Something popped up, yes.
Just within the last hour, somebody's stupidity paid off.
A breaking news Darwin Watch.
Ding. Aaron's going to talk about, I swear to God, he's got Zod casting news. So,
And it's awesome.
I don't know what it is. I've managed to avoid it.
It's exciting.
Really?
Yes.
Excellent. So we got a little Zod casting news and so forth. So that's next hour. Aaron Duran with The Week in Geek. Also, Mr. Ryan Wyatt, music editor from The Oregonian, will be here. And Don Taylor will have a top five. It'll be the top five songs that Don Taylor uses to get herself into show mode.
Mm-hmm. Kiss rocker Paul Stanley and
his... Does it really say Kiss Rocker?
Yes, it does. Kiss Rocker. Paul Stanley and his wife Erin will bring home their third child in August, according to People. The couple already have two children together, 4-year-old Colin Michael and 2-year-old Sarah Brianna. Stanley has a 16-year-old son, Evan, from a former relationship. He told People, "There is nothing greater in life than family, and my accomplishments as a father rank at the top of my successes. Erin and I are blessed with our expectation of the addition of another princess to our family and a new member of the Kiss Army."
God damn. What is it? What is his wife's name, does it say?
Erin.
Erin something or other?
Stanley. I don't know. Yeah.
All right. Because, you know, he was, for the longest time, he was with, what's her name, Donna Dixon.
Really?
Yeah. Although, I guess maybe that was... I'm trying to think if that was like, because is she still with Aykroyd?
I think so.
So then I guess it must have been before that.
That would have been a long time ago because they met on Dr. Detroit.
I don't really. You're such a nerd. I don't really keep track, I guess, of Paul Stanley's conquests the way that I ideally should.
I on the air and know all about Dan Aykroyd's love life.
Well done.
So I don't know why.
Okay.
Gary Winnick, founder of the Indigent Digital Video Collective.
Winnick!
And director of 13 Going on 30 and Letters to Juliet, died yesterday.
Oh, I feel bad now. Sorry.
According to IFC, he was 49. No cause of death was immediately reported. Winnick was inspired to co-create Indigent by the Cinema Verite Dogma 95 movement and worked with noteworthy filmmakers like Richard Linklater and Rebecca Miller on creating low-budget films on digital video. After Winnick's low-budget film Tadpole became a Sundance sensation, he mostly directed Hollywood entertainments, including Charlotte's Web and the pilot for Lipstick Jungle. British fashion designer John Galliano has been suspended from Christian Dior following an altercation in Paris that led to brief detainment by police and charges of anti-Semitic remarks. He was filmed having a vile racist rant during which he declared, "I love Hitler." The designer, who is an alleged hater of Jews, told a woman This happened at a Paris bar, by the way.
Who says I love Hitler, even if it's true? Even if you do love Hitler, who says that?
I don't know. But he was at a Paris bar where he apparently also screamed at two other people last week, which led to him being arrested. He was yelling at people in this bar. People like you, he said he loved Hitler. People like you should be dead. Your mothers, your forefathers would all be effing gassed. After stating he loves Hitler and making the gassing remark, a woman is heard to say, oh, my God, on the video that was made, before asking a slurring Galliano if he had a problem. He said, with you, you're ugly. Asked where he was from, he said, you're a-hole. So, John Galliano is not going to be designing for Christian Dior anymore.
I mean, it's like it sort of started off as merely, like, hateful, and then at the end just became absurd.
Yeah.
Where are you from? You're a-hole.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
There's... Okay.
Charlie Sheen says he wants a raise to come back to the CBS show 2.5 Men. The star appeared on dueling morning show interviews this morning to continue an attack on CBS and producers of his hit sitcom for shutting down the show because of his offset behavior. Both ABC's Good Morning America and NBC's Today Show aired lengthy segments of their interviews in their first and second half hours. NBC interviewer Jeff Brosnan appeared taken aback when Sheen said he wanted to be paid $3 million an episode to return to the show. He's reportedly paid $1.8 million an episode now. You want a raise? Rossin asked. Replied Sheen, yeah, look what they put me through. On ABC, Sheen said to correspondent Andrea Canning he planned to sue his bosses. Wouldn't you? He said, I've got a whole family to support and love. People beyond me are relying on that. I'm here to collect. They're going to lose. They're going to lose in a courtroom, so I would recommend that they settle out of court. He said, also said, CBS owes him an apology, quote, publicly while licking my feet.
I love this country.
He was hospitalized three times in 3 months, and he says now that he's bored with cocaine, but he said he exposed people to magic when they partied with him, and he loved doing drugs. He said on ABC, what's not to love? Especially when you see how I party. It was epic. The run I was on made Sinatra, Flynn, Jagger, and Richards look like droopy-eyed, armless children.
I must find audio of that. Droopy-eyed, armless children.
Droopy-eyed, armless children.
Oh, my God. Here's the thing. Wow. I'm so glad that I didn't know that. The thing about Sheen is like... I mean, where to even begin? The thing about Sheen is I just don't... honestly, now, I just don't know where this ends.
I hope he never, ever stops being in the public eye.
Like he just continues this forever?
I want this run to go as long as possible.
I mean, you know, you think that at some point he's just got to, like, run out of steam or they're going to put him in a booby hatch or he's going to, you know, he'll snuff himself somehow.
Or like Gary Busey, we just get tired of him.
But how could you ever get tired of this, though? I mean,
I know.
Because Busey sort of... The thing about Busey is... Busey's sort of sad crazy to me, in a way. I mean, you know, he's a guy that, you know, he's nuts and he's sort of charming and endearing. But Busey's sort of like a big, kind of, I don't know, energetic but not terribly bright kid. A kid who's a little bit special. And so you sort of, like, you have a sort of sympathy, for, I think, for Gary Busey, whereas Charlie Sheen is just actively awful.
Oh, I know, but he's brilliantly awful. Like, here's another quote from Charlie Sheen. I believe this might have been on ABC. He said, I am on a drug. It's called Charlie Sheen.
I saw that.
It's not available because if you try it, you will die. Your face will melt off and your children will weep over your exploded body.
Awesome. That's fantastic.
Honest to God, I managed to, like, you know, I think this is more entertaining than the entire run of 2.5 Men put together.
It really is. I didn't hear anything. Were there Charlie Sheen jokes last night?
There was one, I believe it was at 6:25 at the beginning of the show. I remember I tweeted, I said, okay, Charlie Sheen joke, who's got the over-under? What time you got in the pool? And sure enough, 6:25, somebody made a Charlie Sheen joke, and I was like, oh, bazinga, there it is. You know, who has that one?
Excellent.
But yeah, there had to be one Charlie Sheen joke.
All right, well, that's a good, we'll just go out. You can't top Sheen. We'll just go out on that. Legion of News comes your way each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. Don't forget this program is available later on today via iTunes or as a direct MP3 download here or at legionofnews.com. The Rick Emerson Show is next, encircling the globe at rickemersonshow.com. That is rickemersonshow.com. Corpse Watch, Taser Watch today, Penis Watch, Aaron Duran at The Week in Geek, and Mr. Ryan White, music editor from the Oregonian. We'll also have today's top five songs that Don Taylor uses to get into show mode. That is all coming up next hour at rickemersonshow.com, where you can be amused day in and day out for the low cost of just 32 cents per day. A giveaway! Thank you for listening. We will see you again tomorrow at noon for Legion of News.